The following episode was recorded live at Star Trek Las Vegas, so there is going to be a fair bit of background noise. Just wanted you to be prepared.
And so I waved at him, and he waved back, and he just kept strolling, and I was thinking, that was really awesome, you know, Brent Spiner, you know, waving back and forth. But I'm still glad I'm not Brent Spiner. But
well, he had a really tough job. I don't know if I think it would be a little strange to go around and have everyone instantly recognize me, especially since, you know, Brent Spiner has a very like noticeable face. He's not like, you know, the kind of person who could in theory like fade into the background. You know, like with Michael Dorn, it's like without his makeup, you'd have to look a little closely to notice it's him. Even like Jonathan Frakes, without like if he's wearing his facial hair differently, he doesn't immediately scream Riker. He looks kind of different now, but with like Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner, you look at them both, it's like, oh, there's Picard and Data. I should go talk to them and bother them, whatever it is they're currently doing.
Yep, definitely. Even like, you know, Leonard Nimoy, he has just a signature face, you know, facial features, and all he does is put the ears on. So even without the ears, you know that's Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, he just has. I'd be interested to see Leonard Nimoy live at some point, because I've only ever seen him in like, you know, pictures and a few other times when he was acting on like some other show, and he always has the Spock look, and I wonder if that's just his affectation when he's posing for the camera, or if that's just what he always looks like in real life. I'd be interested to see that.
I kind of wondered, you know, back in the 70s when I'd watch Star Trek, you know, before The Next Generation and all that, I always wondered, did Leonard Nimoy walk around with the Spock hair, you know, that the bowl cut, the straight bangs? I don't know if that was a wig or if he would put a wig on top of that, but I always thought, you know, when actors do a movie, you see that they may gain weight or they may grow a beard or cut their hair, but it's only a short time, right? It's just a movie. Whereas with Spock doing, you know, three seasons of the original series, he had that bowl cut, the Spock hair, the whole time. So I always wondered, was that his original, like his real hair? Did he cut it that way? How did he deal with that, you know, walking around? Because even if you take the ears off, having Leonard's face and with his signature features and then that bowl cut, everybody, it would be unavoidable. Maybe he'd put a hat on or something.
Well, as I recall from reading, I Am Not Spock, which is the book that Leonard Nimoy wrote, and then he later wrote I Am Spock. Both books are very good. But I think that is actually his hair. I'm not positive, but I think he actually wore his hair like that. Like, it wasn't... I would imagine he probably, like, when he wasn't shooting, he probably styled it a little differently, but I'm pretty sure that on the show he's not wearing a wig.
Did they have, like, you know, styling gel back in the 60s and 70s like that?
Yeah, it was a little different, but they had... I mean, they had greasers, so they must have had something in their hair. I'll admit I'm not an expert on the hairstylings of ye olden days.
The ye old days with the old with the E, the ye old days of the 60s.
Yeah, you know, so long ago and all that. But I would also hazard a guess that back when Star Trek was first airing, he didn't have to worry so much about being recognized, because it wasn't, like, you know, it was popular, obviously, but it wasn't, like, you know, cult phenomenon. It hadn't reached cultural icon status at that point. It was still just, it was a show that people liked. But, you know, like, nowadays, I don't know, like, if you were the, I can't remember her name, but have you ever seen Leverage?
Yeah.
Okay, do you remember the blonde girl? I can't remember the actress's name, but, like, you know, she could probably walk down the street without everyone immediately going, like, oh, man, it's that lady from Leverage. But, you know, it's... So I'd imagine back in the day it was a little bit easier for him to blend in. But I have a question for you, David.
Okay.
So what events have you gone to so far?
Actually, the event that I've gone to has been the Trek Radio Table. I haven't really had a chance to go to a whole lot of these panels, but
David. You're killing me. You are at the convention, and I am back here in Seattle wishing I was at the convention, and you tell me you haven't gone to any events.
Well, and it is... we have tried to go to a few things, and, you know, we rotate who is behind the table. You know, we got a lot of people here. We got our, you know, podcast row. We got, you know, a lot of, not all of our favorite podcasts, because that'd be a whole lot, but, you know, we got a lot of our favorite podcasters here. We got representation for the G&T Show, Podcast UGC, Primetime UGC, Priority One, Stovall Core. And, you know, we would love to have all of our favorite podcasts here. Maybe next year we could do something similar and bring some other people. We got Stoked here. We got Stoked Maverick playing Star Trek Online right next to us. We got a laptop, you know, and then we got a monitor facing outward for the, you know, the fans, the convention goers to, as they pass by. But we also have it playing on a big screen behind us so that everybody's getting their chance to check out Stowe. And it's kind of cool because a lot of the fans here didn't know what Stowe was. You know, they didn't know that it existed. But so we're, you know, introducing new fans to that, and also, you know, to Trek Radio as well. But I've kind of been behind the booth. I mean, I haven't been stuck here, you know, all day and all night. But I have gone around the vendor room floor, and I've been able to, you know, take pictures of.
Here, I'll show you exactly what he's talking about.
I've been able to take pictures of like Chase Masterson, Marina Sirtis, and Gates McFadden as they're doing their signing. We actually got to talk to Robert Picardo. Robert Picardo dropped by our table, sat down next to us, and was talking with us and promoting his charity event auction, like his charity dinner and auction that comes up on Sunday. So that was cool. We had Richard Hurd, a great actor, stop by our booth and sit down. He was a really fun guy. And so we've roamed around the floor, you know, met with Larry Nemechek and, you know, a lot of our favorite people. And then I did get to go around a few times. One of the things that was fun that we did was after the convention closes, like around 7 p.m., there's still a lot of, the vendor floor, you know, the vendor room will close around 7, but then there's still things going on. And one of that I went to was, they do it every year, and they do it all throughout the convention with different things, but it's a panel where they figure out the top 10, best. And so the day before, they did the top 10 best fight scenes in Star Trek. And then the one that I went to was the top 10 best Next Generation episodes. And so they had the whole season, you know, represented. They had little tiles where one photo or one screenshot would represent the episode. Mm-hmm. So they had the whole people there, you know, people in the audience shouting out and suggestions. But then they had a microphone where everybody would go up and talk to the, you know, talking to the mic and say, what would they like to nominate as one of the top 10 best Star Trek TNG episodes? And then they could give a little spiel, a little, you know, description of why they think that is. And some people would go up there, like, it was funny because a little, you know, a young guy went up there and wanted to nominate Rascals as one of the best episodes of TNG.
Ooh!
Yeah, that got mixed reactions from the crowd.
It's okay. When you're young, it's all right to make mistakes.
Yes, definitely.
I used to like Wesley Crusher because I was young and not very smart, but I have since wised up.
Yeah, and there was a lot of debate going back and forth, and, you know, they initially nominated 15 episodes, and then they narrowed it down to 10, and it was surprising to see some of the episodes that people put out there, because, you know, you would expect, you know, the big ones like, you know, Inner Light, Best of Both Worlds, and some of the big ones like that, and they did get mentioned, but people were throwing out like Genesis and Tapestry, some really good ones. Encounter at Farpoint got a vote. I mean, they were saying that's the show, that the episode that started it all. So that's kind of
the Wright Flyer started started fixed wing aircraft technology, but I wouldn't put that on the list of 10 best airplanes.
Yeah, so you could kind of see where people were, you know. Some people were actually, you know, being like analytical or rational, whatever you want to call it, about what is an actual best episode. Like, it was well written. It was like had suspense or drama, or it meant something pivotal to the show. Whereas other people were kind of just putting out their personal favorite, you know. And so there was some debate back and forth, and, you know, some people were saying Masks, and it was just fun to go out there and see all the people, you know, giving out. And it was fun because the first few people, maybe 15, 20 people that went up there to the microphone, they were getting a free Star Trek watch. So that was kind of cool.
What's a watch? Isn't that just like the little thing at the top of your cell phone screen that tells you what time it is? How would you separate that from the phone?
It's like an old-timey chronometer where it's like some of the gauges. But it had the Star Trek logo on it. That was kind of cool.
I want those.
And then earlier today, I caught a little bit of the next one from the same group, the same guy doing that, where it was the top 10 best Star Trek original series episodes. Oop, and we just saw Marina Sirtis walk by the vendor, the table, and then did a 180 and went back the other way. So,
Sirtis.
Yep, Marina Sirtis.
It's okay, Marina Sirtis. I don't like Troy, but I think you're awesome.
Oh, definitely.
You were great in Face of the Enemy. I wish there had been more episodes like that.
Yeah, you know, some of the people, you know, the characters started off one way and we either like them or didn't, but then they would grow and evolve and go through things and, you know, you could see character development.
Yeah. Was
cool.
Troy was just... Face of the Enemy is a really good episode, and it just... I'm watching and I'm just like, why wasn't this what Troy is like all the time?
Yeah.
This is an episode where Troy is actually really good at reading people, and they never straight up say she's using her empathic powers, but I figured that was kind of a given. And she's actually, you know, competent and sets things up, but at the same time, she's not like, you know, an invulnerable Terminator. What she's doing clearly upsets her, so she has, like, an emotional conflict going on, and it's just like, this is how the character should always be. I mean, it would be like if, let's just pick a random episode, if Yesterday's Enterprise was the only episode in Star Trek where we ever got to see Picard, like, grappling with some kind of grand moral dilemma. And it would be like, you know, and the rest of it, he'd just been this really boring, bald captain. And you'd be like, why wasn't he always like that? And, you know, because they knew what they were doing with Picard. But it makes me sad. I don't think they knew what they were doing with Troy. But what events do you want to go to?
Well, I definitely want to check out and just support the Trek Nation that was on Thursday and Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go there. We caught a little bit of it, but you know, I've seen the Trek Nation documentary, but we wanted to go there and support them, and you know, because there's some question and answer going on.
Brandon,
there's just a lot.
How do you switch the camera to follow your target?
I didn't switch the camera to follow your target.
I know we got Mavericks demonstrating still right here, but there's another one that I wanted to see. I'd have to check on the itinerary if it's happened yet or if it's still to come. But there was one about the humanist views of Gene Roddenberry and how that affected the philosophy of Star Trek.
I saw that on the schedule. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, because Star Trek is not really religious. It's not really, you know, always spiritual.
No.
But it does have, like, the humanist, you know, optimism behind it. So that was where, you know... Some people in this modern day would talk about, you know, socialism or something. If you're trying to, you know, keep the, you know, feed the hungry, house the homeless,
mm-hmm.
make everybody, you know, give everybody the essentials in life, you know, not to say get a limousine or, you know, Ferrari, but everybody should be taken care of type of thing. Others might go, you know, in one direction or another with that. But, you know, that's not really political. You know, that's just, you know, taking care of humanity, you know, being, you know, helping everybody, making everybody, you know, make sure they're healthy, they're fed, they're not sick, and, you know.
Yeah.
That's like the vision of the future that we want to see, you know, where we've ended poverty and hunger and everybody, you know, strives to be better.
You would think it's not political, but it gets political really fast, as soon as you start talking. Because, like, you know, you get to the point where it's like, well, in this world, like, everyone has what they need. It's like, okay, that sounds great. But then, like, the moment you start talking about, well, how did they achieve this, then suddenly it's incredibly political.
Oh yeah, definitely, and everything could be made political, and you know there's debates about it all. But yeah, that would have been a really good panel to check out. I have to see if that's already happened or not yet. But that would be hosted by Rod Roddenberry and John Champion, so that would be one of them that I'd want to check out. But there's just so much going on, you kind of can't see everything, so you have to pick and choose. And I know that Terry Lynn and Gettysburg from the G&T show, that was one of the first things they do every convention is open up, crack open the itinerary and just start highlighting the things that they want to see. Because the tough thing is that sometimes there's so many things going on at the same time that, you know, you could kind of, you know, find out, well, this thing's on Saturday in the morning, this other one I want to see is, like, you know, Sunday in the evening. But sometimes there's two things going on right at the same time, so you have to, like, you know, really choose. And I know that Gettysburg from G&T really wants to go see the Ron Moore discussion panel.
That was one that got scheduled for the same time as the discussion with the devs panel.
Yeah, exactly.
There was some hubbub about that.
Yep, and, some, you know, question of their loyalties or their dedication, whether or not they want to support whatever. But yeah, you know, Ron Moore doesn't always come out all the time, so that's kind of a you know, limited opportunity for that. And I think this year they also had Brandon Braga here. I don't know if they're together. I don't think they're together, but...
What is Brandon Braga doing? Is he just at the convention, or does he have a panel? What's his role here?
I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the itinerary again, but...
I looked at the itinerary, and I couldn't find any mention of him. He's just listed as a guest.
What are you doing?
Well, I don't know. He may be at a signing at a table. I'd have to look into that. I don't really remember.
Yeah, I think that's what to do.
The Brandon Braga thing, whatever that was.
Yeah. Interesting. So we were talking about the Trek Nation a second ago, and you've already seen it, right?
Yeah, I've seen it several times. And that's the thing. You can watch it over and over again, and you always, it's not that you always get something new out of it, but it's just, you know, you get to see it, and it's always touching and emotional. But yeah, I did see it a few times, and there's so much discussed and talked about that, you know, you can watch it over and over again. And Roddenberry said that there will be a DVD coming out with bonus features, so we're looking forward to that too.
What did you think of the interview section with Rick Berman? Because that was, like, to me, that was the most interesting part, was like, because the rest of it was cool and, you know, definitely showed me a lot about Rod Roddenberry, but the Rick Berman sections were like the part where I was really kind of listening, being like, all right, what's going on with you, Mr. Berman?
Yeah, and I know that, you know, some people either were really big fans of Rick Berman or some people were really not, you know, so, and a lot of times people would blame him for certain things and either think he was like a mad, you know, not a mad scientist, but, you know, like over things where that really was an eye-opener, and some people's opinion changed about him after Trek Nation because it was like he was wanting to uphold, you know, the Roddenberry philosophy of how Star Trek should be when other writers were wanting to go in one direction or another. And Rick Berman would really be like the keeping it in, you know, like, let's stick to the Gene Roddenberry vision, you know. And so some things that would be blamed on Roddenberry, on Rick Berman, were really not warranted, you know, because he was trying to, you know, keep the torch lit of the Roddenberry philosophy for it. And then, you know, but it came to a certain time where the writers were, you know, we got to go in this other direction, especially with the different shows. And so there's a scene where they put, you know, a blinder on the bust, the statuesque, you know, bust of Gene Roddenberry.
I wonder what part of Roddenberry's vision he thought he was protecting when he fired Ron Moore. Or not Ron Moore, excuse me, Ron Jones.
Yeah, I mean, there's always behind the scenes stuff that we're not always going to be, you know, knowing all the details about. But that was very interesting, and so, you know, that's the thing. If you're a Star Trek fan that, you know, seen all the episodes and you love all of it, you're going to get new things out of Trek Nation. But it's also something where if you've never really watched Star Trek, you can still enjoy it because it's about a son rediscovering his father, you know, that whole story, and then the legacy of finding out, you know, somebody who was connected to Star Trek who didn't fully understand the impact and the legacy of how it touched so many people all over the world. And so, you know, it's a discovery of the impact and legacy of Star Trek. It's about a son rediscovering and reconnecting with their father after the father has passed. And so that's always, you know, a unique perspective, and it's a touching story. And we wanted to see more about Majel. You know, he was saying that a lot of us have said that there should be a sequel that's mostly focusing on his mom.
Mm-hmm.
Some people didn't like, or were kind of uncomfortable, or, I mean, not that they didn't like it, but some people were kind of uneasy or uncomfortable with how candid they were about Gene Roddenberry, because they didn't pull punches, you know, they didn't sugarcoat it, I won't say it's definitely not character assassination, it's not that, but it's definitely like, you know, going behind the myth, going behind the legend, and looking at the real man.
I mean, I always knew he wasn't like the easiest guy to get along with. I didn't really know for sure about the whole like sleeping around thing that he apparently was notorious for. I'd sort of heard rumors about that.
Yeah,
well, and that's I was thinking about it, and I was like, yeah, that's not the greatest thing, but it's not like it ruins my preconceptions of the man. I was glad after watching it that I had never, like, built up Gene Roddenberry as, like, my ultimate, you know, lord and savior sort of thing. Like, I sort of had the same opinion of him after watching it, where it was like, yeah, he was a flawed man who created this really cool thing, is sort of what it came down to.
And that's the thing. I mean, nobody is perfect, and when we do put people up on a pedestal and idolize them and make them into, like, a god among men type of thing, and, you know, the great bird of the galaxy. But it's kind of like goes back to that episode of Firefly when they say, you know, every man who has a statue is some kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know the rest of the quote. So it's like nobody's perfect. Everybody has flaws and vices. And, you know, some people are able to deal with it and grow and overcome that. Other people you know, go down into the deep end and, you know, hit rock bottom. And other people, they're able to function, go to their job, be productive in society, and still, you know, still have their flaws and vices. Whereas people like him, you know, he did such a great thing. He had a vision for the future. He had a, you know, creativity aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, and in a way, I think if you put somebody up on a pedestal as like a genius and just like a god among men, and then they do something great, it's almost like, okay, yeah, well, yeah, obviously they're going to do that. They're some, you know, brilliant, you know, savant genius, you know, Mozart or whatever. But when you kind of bring them down to reality, you see that they are just a person. They're just a man. And that kind of, in a way, to me, it almost makes their achievement that much more better because they are just a regular person. They're like anybody else. They're like, you know, you, me, or the guy next door, whoever. And yet they were able to achieve such a long-lasting, you know, franchise. I mean, to have the idea of it in the first place, you know, that philosophy, and then to do something with it, you know, make it into, whether it's a novel, whether it's a, you know, a comic book these days, or in that day, you know, it would have been a television show or a movie. And then to not just do it and then have it, you know, hit and go away. Like, he built something that lasted all these years later, and it's like, it's never going away now. So that is such a, you know, a monumental achievement. And it does, in a way, it also kind of goes back to what Kalis, the clone, said, is sometimes it's the man is not as important as the man's words and the message. And, you know, everybody's flawed in that thing, but his message to the world, you know, make the world a better place. Tolerance, you know, above all else, and working together, it's an important message, and it still inspires people to get into humanitarianism causes and get into science. And that's why we see, like, Mae Jemison and all these, you know, doctors and scientists that say they were inspired to do their thing because of Star Trek. And I think, you know, what he would have done, you know, adultery or even just, you know, getting fall down drunk in your home or whatever, that's not good. That's kind of a, you know, you could even say that's a bad thing. But I don't want to say, like, well, if you do bad things, just go do a good thing and it'll even it out. But I mean,
I've played a lot of video games, like, you know, with the karma system where once if I kill a bunch of dudes and rob them, I can then go give some water to this, like, starving guy, and it will balance out, and I will be a neutral person. Is that not how it works in real life, David? Are you telling me that video games have lied to me?
Well, in a way, it kind of can work like that sometimes, because people will forgive the flaws and the vices when you do give so much, either, you know, help out the homeless and the needy, or, you know, do some good charity work, or in this case, give something out to the world where it does inspire people to not just accept what's given to them. You know, push forward, try to make things better, try to accept and, you know, and not be, you know, racist or speciesist, or, you know, have intolerance and, you know, bigotry and keeping people separate. You know, it's something where it's like everybody should work together. Everybody should accept and tolerate and, you know, get along and, you know, make the world a better place for everybody, not just like only make it only better for us. You know, let them just, you know, let them go off and do their own thing. Where I think when you give something to the world like that, people will be, you know, will forgive the flaws. I mean, it's not like he was a mass murderer or, you know, anything really heinous like that. So it's like,
I don't know. A lot of Tribbles died in that episode. We shouldn't never forget the Tribbles.
Well, but that's a good thing.
Spoken like a true Klingon.
Exactly. But so yeah, Trek Nation, definitely check it out. And I want to say it's now available for digital download and for renting on like iTunes, on Vudu. It's on Xbox Live. You could rent it on YouTube, but I didn't even know you could rent videos or rent things on YouTube, but I found out that, yeah, you could rent it on YouTube for like $3-$4 or whatever it is.
YouTube is doing weirder and weirder things nowadays. Every time I turn around, YouTube is doing something I didn't know it could do.
But yeah, that's the thing. You know, it's always, you know, growing and changing and ever. But and there will be a DVD available at some point. I think he might be selling the DVD here at the Trek at the Star Trek convention. We'll check that out. We are trying to get Rod to come over to our booth and you know, talk to us about it.
That would be sweet.
Yep.
One thing that I will always be thankful to Star Trek and to Gene for was the basic shape of the Enterprise. Because I don't know, it's not only is it iconic, it's just so dissimilar from a lot of other sci-fi shows. Because, like, I feel like the trend nowadays, and even before Star Trek, is always to make your spaceships look really sleek and, like, really aerodynamic. And it's like, guys, they're in space. Let's be a little more creative here. And I like the shape of the Enterprise and how it's, you know...
And that's why you could have a Borg cube and it's still going to fly through space just fine because... But are you speaking specifically of the original Constitution from the original series, or?
The original one, and like the general shape of the Star Trek ship that it inspired, the saucer, which is clearly the saucer section is clearly a callback to the classical flying saucer. But then it's got, I like the saucer neck drive twin nacelles. Formation. And I'm not saying that every Star Trek ship has to look like that, or even necessarily that every Starfleet ship has to look like that. I'm okay with the Federation ships that look different.
But yeah, I definitely agree, and I think I remember it a long time ago, we were like, over the years, I've tried to catch like every documentary that they make and every interview and stuff, so it's hard to remember which one was which or where did I hear something from, but I remember hearing that when he designed the Enterprise, the original Enterprise, he basically wanted to take the classic iconic UFO flying saucer that was seen so often in the science fiction of the 40s or the 50s and 60s, right? Secondly, where it's like it's Martians coming to eat our brains and, all these different, kind of campy, cheesy, but still fun and awesome sci-fi. But they would always be like flying saucers invade. And so I don't think he took a specific one from a specific movie, but kind of like just think of and design a classic flying saucer.
Mm-hmm.
The saucer of the Enterprise, and then he would take it and he would add to it, and he added almost like aircraft fuselage type things for propulsion. And so when you come out with it, you get that awesome ship. And then I loved it when they went from the original series Constitution to the Enterprise A.
Yeah, the Enterprise A is probably my favorite Enterprise. I guess technically it's the Enterprise refit. It doesn't become the Enterprise A until Star Trek IV, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
I absolutely love the redesign of that ship. I really like the, this is kind of a weird thing, but I really appreciate the fact that the deflector dish on the Enterprise A is actually integrated into the hull.
Yeah.
I don't really like that. That was one of the few things on the original TOS Enterprise that I really didn't like just from looking at it, was that the deflector dish actually being like a dish attached to the hull. That didn't look very sci-fi-ish to me. I really like the blue glow that comes out of the front of the Enterprise A, and the nacelle shape is fantastic. I love that nacelle shape.
And you can see with that reflector dish, that kind of is a callback to the old ideas or the way they would think about the futuristic science fiction stuff. Because a lot of times it would be like satellite dishes, and like, ooh, that's tech, high tech, and that's futuristic. So they basically stick a big satellite dish in front of it. But
yeah.
I do like the. And then you get from the Enterprise A or the Constitution refit, you kind of use that as the inspiration and move things around a little bit. But then you get the next one that I think is one of my favorite of all time for the Federation, at least, is the Miranda class. Because it is different, but it's still somewhat similar. You can see the same thought process, and it looks like they go together even though they're not the same design.
Yeah, the Miranda class I thought was a pretty natural evolution of the design for a smaller, more compact ship. It doesn't have that big drive section. The engines are all sort of in the because it's got like that sort of extended bit on the back of its saucer, and I figure that's where that's where you put the smaller drive section, because I figure the smaller ship doesn't have as high of a power consumption, so it doesn't need that entire separate section.
Yeah, and actually, for those of the... Uh-oh, we got a...
An announcement. I can't hear what they're saying, but it sounds like they're talking about dogs.
Yeah, I actually saw somebody walking by with a little dog on a leash, and I didn't know that they were going to allow little pets in this area.
Maybe if your pet is little enough, you can sneak it in.
Yeah, put it in your... your purse or something. But actually, for those of people who are able to watch the Trek Radio live stream, livestream.com/TrekRadioTV, we had that going for the first 2 days, and we'll probably get it set up again either later today or tomorrow, but they moved it over to the panel, the discussion with the devs panel. But for those of, for everyone who was able to check it out, the live stream, we have a, an actual model of the Reliant, the Miranda class Reliant on our Trek radio table.
It
lights and sound, and you know, I mean, it lights up. It's got the sound effects to it, and it's the kind where it's on a wooden plaque base, and you know, it's one of from one of the great the builders, the vendors here at the convention, and he was gracious enough to let us display some of his ships on our booth. It catches the eye, it brings people over to look at it, and he helped us out with that last year, and so this year he also let us put a few of his ships up on our table. And so I'm looking at the Miranda, and it, you know, the saucer of the original series. Enterprise is like a sphere. Like if you look at top down, it's a circular. It's not a spherical. That would be like a
three-dimensional. Yeah, it's like a perfect circle.
Yeah, it's like a circle top down. Whereas the Miranda has that, you know, elongated bit in the back. And I'm looking at it, and that's where they have some shuttle bays. You know, shuttle bay 1 and 2, I think it is. And then there, it looks like there's a. That's where they put their deflector. You know.
And I think that that's where the impulse engines are too, isn't it?
Like, yeah.
That's what I always thought those blue things were. I thought those were the impulse engines. Maybe those are the shuttle bays. I'm not sure.
Well, they have 1 and 2 listed on those the big blue things. And so I think those are their shuttle bays because the impulse engines are right between that, you know. And so, but, yeah, so you got some stuff going on back there. Look, whether it's shuttle, I think there's some shuttle bays back there. You got the main deflector and the engine, the, you know. But then also, if you kind of look at it, it is compact. It is a little bit smaller, but it still continues – the look of, you know, the nacelles being lower than the saucer.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you just don't have the engineering hole in between connecting it. It's all connected with the struts over the top. But I just love that era. And I definitely love how they took it in the direction with, when they went to the next generation with the Galaxy class, the Enterprise D.
Right.
That looked like a natural evolution of that design where you go from... Because in the middle, they had the Excelsior, they had a... You know, the Enterprise C came later, so
yeah, we didn't get to see the Enterprise C until the Enterprise D was already formally established.
Right. So basically, from a design standpoint, we got to see the original series TOS Constitution. Then we went to the Enterprise A or the Constitution refit, and that was like a natural develop, like you said, a natural evolution expansion of it because it would it made it more sleeker. You know, there's angles where things were, you know, straight up and down or straight vertical in the Enterprise A. It was like sweeping forward, and it just made it look like, you know, a natural evolution that way. Angles were changed. But then you go to the Enterprise D, and it looked like the same design, you know, the saucer, the main hull, and then the nacelles come out to the pylons come out to the nacelles. But it seems like more organic, you know, all the curves and the angles. It could almost seem like, you know, almost an organism or something.
Right.
I just love all the angles and the curves of...
The Enterprise D weirded me out a little bit at first because the saucer section just seemed really oversized compared to the rest of the ship. It seemed very, like, bulbous. And I don't know... This is a problem that kind of went away, and I don't know if they actually changed the model or if they just got better at filming it. But, like, in the later seasons, I never noticed that. But even now, when I go back and watch the first season, and I look at the way that the... Because in the first season, they love to have these shots where the... I think what they were doing was that the model was actually angled up a little bit. So you have the saucer section, which is much closer to the camera and looks enormous. And then a little bit below it, you have the drive section and the nacelles. And I was just... Like, the ratio didn't look right. And then, like, later they stopped doing that, and it looks a little more natural. And I don't know if they made any changes to the model or what. But yeah. I think they got better with it as the show went forward.
Well, I don't know if they, like, totally changed, like, dimensions and, you know, specifications or that type of, you know, curve ratios or whatever you want to call it. But I think that they did make a bigger model because I think there was, like, by the end of the season, they had a really, really huge Enterprise, and they always had it upside down. And when we talked to, I think it was either Larry Nemechek or Doug Drexler, but, you know, there was times where they were filming, you know, and it would just be the people, you know, on the set, and on the bridge, and then they're in their uniform, and then the people would do special effects or whatever. But it was like always, and for the production people, it was always a big thing where they called it, where they were filming new things, because obviously they would reuse you know, certain flybys or certain angles, they would already have it, and, you know, so they would just reuse it again for, the, you know, a beauty shot or an establishment shot. But anytime there was, like, new things going on where they needed new footage of the ship doing different things, they would have to, you know, go into the rig and film it. And so what they would call it is ship on a stick. And I just think that needs to be a candy or something. They need to market that somehow. It'd be something like that.
I would eat a candied Enterprise D.
Exactly. But they said anytime that they had the Enterprise or any of the ships out there for filming, all the production people would, like, rush over and want to watch it and see the process. But they would say, almost like on telephones, they'd call someone and say, hey, ship on a stick, and everybody would just rush over. But so towards the end of the season, they had the really, really huge Enterprise, and it was upside down so that they could, you know, fly through it. But I know what you mean. I do think that the saucer seemed to change a little bit, and I think the thickness of it. Ooh, there goes Garrett Wong walking by.
Hi, Garrett Wong. I love Garrett Wong. His interview where he talked about the making of Voyager is really enlightening.
Yep, it's awesome. He's over there talking with the Richard Arnold booth. You got a lot of trading cards, a lot of collectibles over there. And so, he's over there talking.
Have you seen Of Gods and Men?
I've seen little bits of it. I've seen, like, you know, clips or, you know.
Of Gods and Men is the show that really made me realize how wasted Garrett Wong was on Voyager. Like, in Gods and Men, he's wearing, like, the Kirk-style green tunic with, like, the gold lamé trim, and it's got, like, his, like, it shows his chest, and he's, like, got this incredibly sculpted physique. And I'm just watching him, and I'm like, damn, I didn't think I would be attracted to another man like that. That is impressive. And I was like, you know, if they had given him a couple of scenes or just something where he'd gotten to do something like that on Voyager, I would have liked that show so much more.
Well, the one thing that when we interviewed Garrett Wong recently with the, in connection with the sci-fi science fiction convention,
mm-hmm.
we talked to him about that. And one thing that was really unfortunate that he said that, you know, some of the actors would try to, you know, resist or, you know, say that they disagreed with, but they got shot down again was they would tell some of the actors, you know, okay, put it this way. You know how there's the cliche in, like, theater where they say once more with feeling. In, but make it, you know, bigger and more feeling. They would actually tell them the opposite. They would tell them that the humans would have to be more, like, subdued, some more, you know, sterile, or, you know, more bland. And that was because, you know, the aliens were the ones that were supposed to, you know, pop out or, you know, be the spotlight type of thing. And so they would do a line, they would do it one way, and the director, the writer, the people on the set would tell them, like, do it less, you know, do it more, you know, robotic almost. And so they're saying he was saying there was some people that were so funny, you know, in between sets, they were making each other laugh and crack up, and that him particularly, he wanted to be funny, right? Because that's the cool thing about Star Trek is it has the drama, it has tension, but it always has had humor. And so on certain cases, you would want, like, you know, tension and dramatic acting where they would say, do it less. But for him particularly, he wanted to be able to be funny. You know, not like the, you know, over the top or whatever, but it was just unfortunate. And like we've said, we've talked about it on the G&T show, that did hurt Voyager. It hurt the characters. And it hurt. And so I don't know why they did that. And so.
And poor Robert Beltran. Like, really, God, he's not even allowed to smile most of the time. I think if you looked at Voyager and measured it, especially in the early seasons, I think Robert Beltran would probably have the fewest lines. I think he might even have fewer than Kim. Like, some of the episodes where he basically does nothing. He gets his one line to, like, fulfill his contract.
It's just unfortunate, but, I mean... And then we talked about one question that we asked him was what was his favorite starship, and he went with the Voyager, the Intrepid class. And I remember at the time some people didn't like the Voyager because we saw, you know, all the Enterprises, we saw the Enterprise D, and I think at that point we also had seen the Defiant, you know, when it started. And then when Voyager comes out, it's like so elongated up in the front.
Yeah.
And, you know, the nacelles are different. And the hull, like the engineering hull, the main hull is, like, integrated almost into the – there's no real neck to it. It's just kind of all one. And I remember people didn't like it, and even me, I was like, eh, you know, I didn't hate it. I just didn't, you know, like it all that much. I mean, you know, I didn't have a particular liking for it. It's like, okay, it is what it is. But over the years, I've kind of grown to it. Oh my God, here we go. We've got so many great costumes here at Star Trek Las Vegas, right? We're broadcasting live from the vendor room in the Rio Hotel and Casino. We're here at the Star Trek Las Vegas Convention Live. You see so many great costumes walking by, right? But I think here's one of the most inventive and creative and kind of weird. And, I don't think we're going to be able to beat it. This guy's walking by in a costume of a crystalline entity.
Oh, wow. Do you have a camera?
No, we got to get a picture of that.
I mean, if you need to walk away from the mic and ask him if we can take a picture, you go ahead, because I want to see that. I can't see it.
Yeah, give me a minute. We're going to go try to get a picture of that guy. So vamp it. Fill it. Hold on.
All right. Well, I am going to fill in while David goes to see if we can get a picture of a guy in a crystalline entity costume. And that is, I mean, I'm having a hard time even, like, figuring out what that looks like. Wow. I mean, because the crystalline entity was always one of my favorite, alien beings that they ever ran into in Star Trek, because it was just so strange. And I really liked the few episodes it was in. I honestly wished there had been more. Like, I was, even though the episode where it's destroyed is really good, I wish they had used it more than they did, maybe. Because I really felt like there should have been more than one, right? Unless it was a constructed creature, it was actually built by somebody, which would also make sense. I mean, you know, it devours life by the planet load, so it makes sense that it would be constructed.
No, I'll be here. You'll be here.
But I always wanted there to be more. If it wasn't, like, if it was part of a species, I felt like we should have seen a few more of where maybe. And for all we know, they could have had it be that the one that was destroyed in that TNG episode. I don't remember the name of it, but with the with the lady who, tricked Picard into blowing it up because they were trying to find a way to talk to it.
Yeah. I'm back.
Okay, David's back.
But I agree with you. I always wondered about that, you know, because we saw, several different space-borne life forms. We saw the Gomtu, that living ship, and then later on we saw the Junior or the Gekli, you know, the one that attached itself to the Enterprise.
Right.
Every time we only saw one of it, or I guess, you know, with the Gekli, we saw the mother and the offspring, but especially with the crystalline entity, I wondered, you know, because all the rest of them, like Gomtu, we had the little, you know, encounter with it, and then it goes off on its way.
Yeah.
The Gekli ones, you know, they accidentally killed the mother, but then the little offspring was able to go off on its way. But the crystalline entity, they destroyed it, and it was kind of like an aggressive, malicious kind of way.
Well, I mean, if you remember, they were tricked. Like, that was one of my favorite. That was like one of my favorite Picard moments. Is where Picard is talking about how it's not necessarily evil. Like, we don't, you know, it may very well just be doing what it needs to do to survive, and maybe there's a way we can, like, reach an arrangement with it where we can provide it a food source that doesn't involve it killing us.
Right, and I like the analogy made in that episode about the whales, that, you know, when it eats on the millions of little cuttlefish or whatever it eats on, it's not doing it out of hatred or malice, it's just feeding, you know.
Yeah.
And if you're one of the little fish, you're thinking, oh my God, you know, this thing is horrible, but from the real perspective, it's just eating, it's just having to feed itself. And once they did destroy it, I know the Enterprise didn't destroy it, I mean, the crew didn't destroy it, they were tricked by that, mm-hmm. by that crazy, crazy old lady. But once it was destroyed, I kind of always wondered, was that the last of its kind? Because that would just be sad. But was there others out there that would want to come, you know, eventually someone, you know, the Enterprise has an episode where the mate or, you know, the parent or the child or whatever, like another one of those things comes to attack the Enterprise to get retribution. But I always like that, you know, the idea that there are space-borne life forms out there. And that was my impression, too, that the crystalline entity was like a creature. You know, it was like a life form, because we see the Tholians. They're made out of like a crystalline, crystal-type structure type of thing.
Oh, man. I just thought of the coolest story. You could this could be a Foundry mission, even. The crystalline entity is like a constructed being made by the Tholians. It was some kind of like weapons test that completely got away from them.
That would be awesome. That would almost be like akin to when, like, you know, humanoids or something do like a genetic engineering.
Mm-hmm.
In the Deep Space Nine episode, the Hunters, they created Tosk.
Right.
TOSK would have never been around if the hunters hadn't genetically, you know, engineered and created it. So that could almost be a similar thing where the Tholians did something like that. But yeah, and that's just awesome to see. We definitely got a picture of the guy in the costume.
Sweet.
I wanted to say that, you know, I've said it a few times, but just to remind everybody, we will be posting a gallery on TrekRadio.net with all of the pictures. I mean, I've taken several, Kane, you know, all of our DJs and podcasting friends here have taken pictures, and even some of the convention goers have said that they would like to either, you know, contribute or send us some of those pictures. So we're going to get a big old gallery going and have that up there on TrekRadio.net soon. So everybody who could not attend and was not able to, you know, check out our live stream, we'll be able to see the cool costumes, and there's some really good ones out there. Right now, I think everybody's gearing up for what are we doing? What's everybody getting ready for? What's the next panel right now?
The next big panel is the TNG 25th Anniversary Reunion Extravaganza Spectacular Panel,
woohoo,
or something like that.
And there's not enough descriptors in there.
No, you can't have enough descriptors for next gen.
Has anyone gotten their copies of the TNG Blu-rays yet?
People go and follow us on Twitter, or just go to twitter.com/TrekRadio. You'll see maybe 50 pictures from the costume contest that they had. Yeah, they just had the attempt for the Guinness record. Fell a little short.
Oh, we didn't break it this year. We didn't break it this year then.
No, but it's still a record, so we didn't break our own.
Okay.
But we'll try again next year.
See, I should have been in my Klingon uniform. See, it's all my fault because I wasn't in my Klingon uniform this time.
You would have put us over the top, absolutely.
Oh, darn it. Well, next year we're going to try again. We'll do it. We'll do it next year.
Because we were just talking about the guy in the crystalline entity costume. What other cool costumes have you seen so far?
Well, we've definitely seen a lot of Starfleet people, which is all from all the different eras and TV shows. You know, Enterprise, TOS, even the JJ TOS uniforms. You know, definitely all the incarnations of TNG, DS9, Voyager. But so there's always that. We saw a really good Borg, you know, a guy with all the tubes and the laser on his head, and a really good Borg. We saw a Jem'Hadar, a really good effect where it was a Jem'Hadar. We saw a couple of Romulans, a couple of Klingons. We even saw one that was a really elaborate robe costume for a Vulcan, like a Vulcan dignitary. That was really cool. But I'd say some of the, aside from the crystalline entity, one of the most, and we definitely have seen some Orions. Have you seen any green girls yet?
Well, it's not really a Star Trek convention until you see the green women.
You go to twitter.com/TrekRadio and you scroll down, and you are going to see some green girls. That is for sure.
Awesome. Did you see the Orion guys?
Yes, I did see the Orion guys.
There need to be more of those. We need a more balanced environment in our Star Trek. Man, that is a lot of Star Trek pictures. There's a lot of Star Trek costumes. Oh man, there's some people in the dress uniforms from the third TNG movie. I'm forgetting its name. Insurrection. There's like a couple of guys in the white dress uniforms.
Yeah, we've definitely seen a lot of the white uniforms. I've seen several of those, and we also have seen a really good Gorn that, you know, you could see up there. But one of the ones I saw was a kind of along the lines of the TNG. I mean, the Jem'Hadar. We saw a Hirogen. A Hirogen Borg,
and you could tell that by looking at him.
Yep, he had the full face makeup, face mask to be a Hirogen, and also the body was like, he had the implants and he had the wire, you know, the tubes and the wires. It was just really awesome. He had a Hirogen Borg. There's some really good costumes out there. I just can't wait to see all of them, you know, on all of the pictures, because I've taken several, but then we've also seen other people have come up and showed a picture on their camera, like, hey, check out what I just saw, and it's some really good stuff.
Oh, wow, that's cool. So I have a question about one of the events that I was looking at. There's going to be a panel on the Inner Light. I don't know if that's happened yet or not. But the panel describes that there was going to be a sequel to the Inner Light. Does anyone know what that's about? Because that sounded really cool. It was it's being hosted by Morgan Gendel, the guy who wrote the Inner Light.
I don't know if that panel has happened yet, but I wanted to know more about it. But what I've briefly heard about it was that there was supposed to be a sequel to the Inner Light, and if I remember right, it was going to be called the Outer Light, which is kind of interesting. And I didn't know the premise of the story. I didn't know like what they were going to do, but I did hear the fact that like there was a planned sequel and it was going to be called Outer Light. But I wanted to know more about that. I don't know if that's out there on the internet or if it's kind of like, you know, not been discussed too much and would be kind of unveiled or, you know, shown off for the first time. I don't think there's any script or
probably not,
you know, video, but they're going to talk about the plan or the idea for it. But I don't know. I didn't hear about, you know, what the premise was going to be or anything like that. So I did want to know more about it. So that would definitely be cool to check out.
Because the Inner Light is one of those episodes where I keep wanting them to reference it more, because it is such a good episode, and it should have had like a life-changing impact on Picard. And they reference it a little bit, like he's got that flute that he has in a couple of episodes, but he isn't as changed as I would expect him to be from that kind of experience. And I think it would have been really nice to see more of that.
I agree. There's times where, and that's the difference between TNG and DS9, is they kind of didn't want to become a serial. They wanted a lot of it to be episodic, or, you know, where most of it is standalone. But TNG kind of blurred the line with that sometimes, because they would do, you know, not just two-parters, but they would do stuff in, you know, season one or two that would carry over and you would see the effect of it in later seasons. But then they still had a lot of, you know, standalone or bottle shows or, you know, one-off type of thing where that's what I liked about DS9 is it really did carry on more often. You know, what was happening, the events would have repercussions and consequences that would carry on. And I thought that too. I mean, you know, on one hand, you could think that the way they always said Picard is a very private man.
Yeah.
He might have, you know, been feeling that and not letting it out to the crew, you know. So outwardly, he would still be his stoic, you know, refined persona, and you wouldn't really see it. But then the way I thought, well, if that was the case, that he was, like, feeling it, but he would just kind of repress it, then you would have the episode where it's the one-on-one with him and Troy, kind of similar to what we saw in the movie when his family perished in the fire. And I thought that was another thing we should have seen more of. Once we saw that in that one movie, I thought they should have been doing that all along, where it's like he's, you know, Mr., you know, unbreakable, unwavering, you know, strong captain, stoic. But then, and if you do it too much, then you could run the risk of making him seem wishy-washy or, you know, or anything like that. But at certain key times, I think they should have did that, where you would see him being counseled by his counselor, by, you know, Troy.
David, the first rule of TNG is that Troy is never allowed to do her job.
Exactly.
This is the first thing. And that's actually, I think, a problem with American television in general. That's not just a Star Trek thing. But, like, can you think, how many, like, effective psychologists can you think of in television? It always ends up being, if the character ever goes to a psychologist, it's always so that the psychologist can tell him something that is wrong, and he can then, and it's usually a he. If it's a female character, they have, you know, maybe they'll actually get some help. But usually if it's a guy, they go to a psychologist, and the psychologist says some mumbo-jumbo at them, and they're like, you're stupid, and your profession is stupid, and I know what's wrong with me. And then he goes and fixes it himself. That's just an American television trope, and I hate it. I can't stand it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And the other thing that I think lends to that, like, is in some ways was a benefit, but in this particular case, what we're talking about could be a liability or a, you know, a detriment, whatever you want to call it, was the fact that they would change writers so often. And they had a writing team, but they would pull in writers for just one or two episodes. And then they would, especially during TNG, they would even take spec scripts and, you know, kind of take those and modify it. But and in some way, like I'm saying, that some ways that you get benefits from that. But in some ways, that could kind of hurt you, because you don't have the same people writing the characters and knowing their inner turmoil or their, you know, their inner thoughts and their inner being type of thing. So,
yeah, that's true. All right. So normally at this point in the show, this is a regular All Things Trek episode, we would take a music break. Do you want to do that, David?
We could do something like that. Let me look what music we have available.
Yeah,
I think we could do that. So you're listening to Trek Radio and All Things Trek. And we're broadcasting live from the vendor room in their fabulous Rio Hotel and Casino. We're at the Star Trek Las Vegas Convention 2012 Creation Entertainment Convention. And we're just having a great time here. So we're going to go to some music. I'm going to try to look for something that we could play that is, you know, suitable, but we're not going to have, you know, mature content out here at the convention. But yeah, stay tuned. We're going to come back. And here right now, we're talking with the Vulcan. So I'm going to play a song dedicated, one of my favorites. Here's Leonard Nimoy and Highly Illogical.
You're listening to the podcast and archive of All Things Trek. Music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live Saturday 1 to 3 Pacific Time on Trek Radio.
And we're back at Star Trek.
Huh. Can you guys hear me all right? You guys are awful Skypey on my end.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Hold on, let me is anybody in the chat room out there? Can everybody hear us? Are we loud enough? Are we clear enough?
You're better now. I can hear you again, regular.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. Somebody's saying that we got an echo going on. What's going on here?
I think they were talking about you were like Skyping in and out. Like I could hear basically every other word, but you seem to be clear now.
Oh, okay. Is it sounding clear now? Was I Skypey, robot-y?
It was some kind of very extreme Skyping. Like you were saying a sentence and you would cut out like at roughly even intervals. It was very strange to listen to. But it seems to have, I think, resolved itself.
Yeah, hopefully everything's going good. You know, that's the thing. We got Tribbles in the system. I think maybe some of the Borg nanites have got into our system here from a...
If there are Borg here, we have to call Admiral Forrest to investigate. Because, you know, clearly if something weird goes on at a frozen Arctic research station, you would send your highest ranking Starfleet Admiral to go check it out.
Exactly. Go send the president to check on a military, you know, in the worst situation, go send your highest, most important person.
It seems that we've had some kind of explosion at this like jet propulsion lab, but don't worry. President Obama is on his way to investigate.
That's awesome. We just had a really good a family come by the Trek Radio table here at the booth here at the Star Trek Las Vegas, and they're all in costume, they're all in uniform, and they're saying that, you know, they're kind of getting separated, not separated, but, you know, kind of like the way some families do, they all go off in their own rooms, and they're off in their own, you know, the kid going off to their room to do their computer, the different parents going off to do their own thing. And they wanted to get, you know, they didn't want the technology to divide the people, you know, where everyone's just off looking at their own iPhone or their own computer screen. And they wanted to come back together, right? So they ended up wanting to get into Star Trek Online so that they could all play a game together. And even if they are in their own rooms or, all, you know, their own separate spaces, they're all going to be able to play it together. And they're, you know, asking us questions about, you know, what is Star Trek Online? How do we do it? What, you know, just general stuff about it. And so we are introducing them. We're showing it to them on the screen, but also, you know, telling them to, you know, check out Trek Radio. We got a great community in our IRC chat room and our, you know, in our social media. But that's just really cool. You know, you can see how Star Trek brings families together and, you know, crosses the generational gap. So that was always awesome. I was glad to hear that. And we played some cool songs for them. We had some requests directly from the convention floor. They wanted to hear some Star Trekkin' by The Firm. And then they had never heard Shatner of the Mount, so we had to play that for them.
How could they not have heard that?
Oh, exactly. We had to introduce them to it. But we got a lot of great costumes and a lot of great fans walking by. Oh, look at that. That's I forget his name. Look at that.
Who is he? Is he an actor, or is he someone dressed up as a character?
In the backpack. From Travel Rock. This guy walking by in a regular outfit, he's got his backpack on, and sticking out of the backpack is like a puppet or like a stuffed toy.
It's like a tricker.
But it was the main guy from Fraggle Rock. You know, like the one that would go out exploring, the Fraggle. That would go out to the real world. Remember how they always stayed under their underground cavern, into their own little Fraggle area. But there was the one Fraggle Rock guy that went out exploring, and he always was trying to interpret the real world, but he would always misinterpret it wrong. And like, you know, I think this is what's going on here, and it would be totally something else. And that was just awesome, a little stuffed toy, you know, plushy version of that Fraggle Rock guy. I just forget their name.
Huh.
I've never actually seen Fraggle Rock, but that's a...
How could you not see Fraggle Rock? I mean, come on.
There are some things I haven't seen, all right? Some things.
The dozers. Uh-oh, we got NX01 Dave out here at the Trek radio table, and we're trying to ambush him and assimilate him, but
get him.
Get him behind the table.
Face to a name. It's good.
Use the wide beam stun setting.
Yep, we got to use that. We got to... and Havraha is walking up back over to the Trek radio table. Yes. Trek radio.
Wait, Havraha is a real person? He's not like just a voice in a box? I don't understand.
Hold on. We got a question out here. So is Havraha a real person, or is it just a voice in a box behind Helmet, or what do you think around here?
No. I am a slice of cheese.
Oh, well, obviously. I knew that.
Uh-oh. So, yeah, we got a lot of great podcasting friends, a lot of great friends of the station out here. We got some fans that came down, and we got Soridium, we got Koroth from Gates of Stovacor and the G&T show over there sitting down. Everyone's kind of filtering around back and forth, and then we kind of look around and go, where did they go? And they're just gone. And then, a couple minutes later, they come back and, oh, where you been? And they're going out and buying some cool stuff or sitting around. Hey, Koroth.
Cool stuff to buy at a Star Trek convention? I would never have thought.
I know, exactly. But, Sori's getting behind the computer, going to play some Star Trek online.
So speaking of the warriors of the, of the Gates of Stovacor, I plugged this already back last week, but on the off chance there are people listening who weren't listening then. The last episode, or I guess it's second to last now, because you guys have done Women of the Empire since. And that one was also very good. But I really loved your guys' Firefly spoof, or Serenity spoof. I thought that was hilarious.
Awesome. Hold on a second. Oren from All Things Trek is saying that he really liked not the most recent episode, which was the Women of the Empire, but he really loved the one, the Firefly homage.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, I thought that was hilarious. I was listening to it at work.
It's a fun episode to play with, and we were glad to put it together.
I'm not getting that mic. We got to use this one.
The episode was written by Gar. He wanted to do something fun and interesting involving Firefly for a raid. He's a pirate, so it was something that he wanted to kind of explore and thought that it would be a nice homage. So he put the episode together. We looked it over, revised it, and we ended up recording, putting it together. And, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, now, how do you guys – what's your process when you're writing these scripts? Like, do you do, like, a Star Trek Online mission and then are like, that was a cool mission, let's write a script about it? Or do you – like, have an idea for a script and then are like, I want to, let's go play this out in Star Trek Online and then we'll figure out how the story's going
to
go.
Hang on a second. We're going to pass the mic and the earphones over to Soridium for a second.
Okay.
He was asking about the process of how do we do an episode. Do we watch an episode? I mean, do we play a mission?
Hello.
Hello.
What's the question?
All right, so my question that I had was, what's your guys' process when you're writing these scripts? Like, do you do a mission in Star Trek Online and then sit down and are like, that was a cool mission, let's write a story about it? Or do you have, like, a story in mind first, and then you go out and play a mission in Star Trek Online? How does that work?
Well, usually what we want to do is we want to talk about or feature some aspect of the game. So whether it's a duty officer or a mission or something along those lines, what we'll do is we'll either play it, check it out, and we'll brainstorm a bit and, to see how we want to go about it. And then we'll sit down, write a script. It'll go through two or three revisions, and then we'll sit down and start recording it. Once it's recorded, then we begin the editing process. And sometimes we have to remove lines, add lines. It all depends on what the episode or the story is going to call for.
Where do you guys get your sound effects?
Good question. We use TrekCore. We use the internet in general, just some free sound effect websites, wherever we can.
Awesome. Yeah, I really like the show, so I wanted to know how your process was for writing it. Have you gone to any cool events? Because I was trying to get David to tell me what his favorite event was, and apparently he's been manning the booth the entire time.
I've been running around representing GNT, Gates of Stovall. We did karaoke. I got up on stage and I sang a Klingon battle song, a cappella, which was a lot of fun. Got a big rise out of the crowd. And yeah, Klingon support and Klingon love is definitely here in Star Trek Las Vegas.
Are you in your Klingon outfit?
I do not have a Klingon outfit, but my heart, my soul, I'm a Klingon.
Fair enough. You can be Klingon on the inside.
Yes.
Is there anything in particular you're looking forward to doing?
Well, this morning there was the Stowed discussion with the devs. That was great. I'm looking forward to this evening sitting down with them, having a drink, and asking some more questions in a more intimate setting. So that's really, you know, I'm here for the people, you know, to meet my friends, make new friends, and just enjoy myself.
What did you guys talk about at the discussion with the devs?
Well, there was a lot of discussion about various aspects of the game, what's coming, what we had to look forward to. I was in line, but I never got a chance. They had to shut down the room to get prepared for the costume contest thing. So I never got a chance to ask my question, which was going to begin with kapla and followed up with, you know, the Klingon Empire. And, you know, when will we see a little, you know, another mission or more missions for the Empire?
Poor Klingon Empire. I really like I mean, I've always been a huge Klingon fan, and that was one of the reasons why I haven't really picked up Star Trek Online. I was looking at the Klingons, and I was like, you know, I kind of want to have a Federation and a Klingon character, and I don't feel like I get my full mileage out of the Klingon character. It doesn't look like there's quite enough to do.
Well, you can actually level from level 25 all the way to end game. That is a smooth progression. However, because people are already playing a Fed up to level 25, there tends to be, you know, a loss of that. You know, people don't want to just give up what they're working on to start a new tune, especially a Klingon. So there are hurdles for the faction, and really the best and only way to bypass those hurdles are to have a more complete faction where you level from level 1 all the way to Memphis.
When are they going to let us kill Jempok? Because I will play Star Trek Online. That is one of my conditions, where if they let me kill Jempok, I'll play Star Trek Online. When are they going to let us do that? That guy is something I can't say on Family Hour of Star Trek. Because, like, isn't the story that he basically, like, went into a room with Martok, and then Martok was dead, and he's like, I'm the Chancellor now?
Yeah, after 3 hours or so of intense negotiations.
Is that what was going on?
Well, we don't really know what was going on. It was a closed door session, so, you know, there are a number of theories. You know, he's an Undine, he's a changeling, he's, you know, a Romulan, Romulans. But but no one really knows. And Kestrel, although she has an idea, she's not telling.
Well, because I was always under the impression that the whole, you know, kill your superior to take their rank thing had, like, rules and etiquette to it. Because, like, if it didn't, there would be no way for their society to function, because everyone would be constantly stabbing everyone else in the back. So I sort of assumed that one of those rules was, yeah, have to do it out in the open where everyone can see, and, like, I don't know. That whole thing struck me as being very shady, and I always, because, like, in Deep Space Nine, when Worf kills Gowron and then makes Martok the Chancellor, it's because Gowron is royally messing up the war effort. And there's sort of the unspoken, everyone knows Gowron has to go, and so it's all right for Worf to do what he does. But I was sort of under the impression that if you just tried to, you know, walk up to the Chancellor and be like, I want to be Chancellor, I'm going to murder you, and that Chancellor was well-liked and doing well, he would be like, no, you can't do that.
Well, to to turn down a challenge is dishonorable.
Right.
So no matter what, even if it is an in private challenge, you have to accept it. You have to go through with it. And granted, if it's a closed door session, you know, there could be a number of things that occur. You know, someone could cheat. Someone could have assistance that no one else knows about. So they do try to keep things out in the open. However, I don't think it's actually a requirement. I think the only true requirement is to be able to. You can only challenge your direct superior. You can't, you know, be an ensign or a lowly, you know, Beck, as we Klingons like to say, and challenge, you know, a captain. That is not allowed.
But
you'd only be able to challenge your direct superior, and that's only if they act dishonorably.
Yeah, and see, that's the part that I don't get, is what did Martok do to warrant this challenge? Like, and the direct superior thing doesn't also make a whole lot of sense, because in Deep Space Nine we saw Worf challenge Gowron, and Worf isn't anything like Gowron's direct subordinate. In fact, Worf doesn't even have a Klingon rank at that point.
Shipyard under construction. What?
That is true. Worf did not, but he was. What Gowron was doing was so dishonorable, and even Martok wanted to, but he didn't want the power. He didn't want the position of Chancellor. So
right.
He really didn't want to be the one to do the challenge. But everyone knew that someone had to challenge. Worf was the one that had no ties. He was the one. He was really the only one that could get away with it and live. I think that's why it was able to get away with it. It was because he had no direct ties to any particular house. There was nothing to question his honor.
I suppose that's fair. So here's something that I've always wondered about conventions. I'm getting back to the Star Trek convention. So they have these things that you can like, where you can like pay money to like go have like lunch or something with like one of the celebrities. Have you ever done that?
I have not. This is actually my first convention. So this is a huge learning experience for me. I'm going around and discovering all kinds of fun and new things. And I spend most of my time in the vendor's room just watching people walk by, and it's amazing. I mean, the costumes are wonderful. I can tell you how many Klingons I've seen throughout the weekend, and today I can tell you there are Romulans everywhere.
Well, you know, if they're not going to give us the amount of Romulans we want in the show, we have to make up for it.
Very true, very true.
Do you have any particular autographs that you're looking to get?
Again, I'm not really here for, you know, the stars themselves. I'm here, you know, to meet my friends and to make new friends and to meet people, you know. Hopefully get more listeners to our shows and bring more attention to the Klingon faction for Star Trek Online.
Cocaine is going to be calling you.
Yeah. All right, hang on. I had more things I wanted to ask about this convention that's happening right now.
Sure. My answers may not be great, but, you know, I can only tell you about my experience.
What's your favorite costume that you've seen so far?
Oh, wow. Although there's a very interesting Orion just a few feet away from me.
That's cheap.
I certainly can appreciate. But there has been a Hirogen Borg.
Mm-hmm. God, David was telling me about that. That sounded amazing.
Yes, very, very nice. And let's see. I've met a pair of Binars, female Binars. Let me tell you. So, yeah, there's a lot of great costumes. The cosplay is amazing. And there's a lot of people doing a lot of wonderful things. It's very creative.
All right, so I'm going to pitch this costume idea to you. I think this is something we should do for next year. Because there was some kind of, I think it may even have been at PAX, where there was a fellow going around dressed up as the weighted companion cube from Portal. So I think, with a little work, we could make a Borg cube costume. We would maybe need some people to, like, clear space, because I'm imagining this thing will probably be something like 7 or 8 feet wide, which, you know, there may be, like, a hallway issue, I don't know. But I think we're on the right track with this idea.
The getting into the hotel room might be a factor at the end of the evening, but that sounds interesting. I would definitely, you know, kind of be wary or you know, definitely clear a path if I see a Borg tactical cube come in my way.
So while I've got you on here, can you give me any hints about what's coming up next for the Gates of Stovacor?
Let's see. We're going to be winding down our season soon. We have, I think, 3 or 4 episodes still yet to come. Let's see. We've done a Kestrel interview. We've released Women of the Empire. We have an introduction episode with one of our newest members, Scald. He's a Gorn, and so we get to introduce him. We are going to be having a small series, I think it's like 2 or 3 episodes, leading up to and getting into a, I believe it's an infected ground elite run, where we basically are running it with Priority 1 and going through the motions and explaining how, you know, how to get through it without, you know, and achieving the elite bonuses. And then finally, another idea that we're playing around with and still working on is a series finale, or a season finale, I should say, where we have a sort of pirate Academy Awards ceremony. So a lot of fun stuff, a lot of interesting things. And all of our episodes, we try to tie them back to Stowe in one way or another, whether one aspect of Stowe that we're getting a lot of great inspiration from is the Doff missions. They're very small, very general, very generic, but there is so much storytelling possibilities within them. So we're just having a blast going through them, picking out a few, and seeing where our imaginations take us.
How long does it take you to go from like the raw voice recordings to like the edited project?
Best case scenario, we can have everything done. Well, just on the editing side?
Yeah.
2 days of 16-hour days.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there you go.
Hours, we've got a full episode ready to post.
Yeah, because that was why I stopped doing like the little radio drama that we had going on Trek, or on All Things Trek, was just because like I would get everything like recorded, and then it would take me like 4 months to finish the editing, and I was like, this is just too long. There's no like this. It's unreasonable to ask people to wait that long between episodes. But so I'm really impressed that you guys get it done so quickly.
Well, we try to keep most episodes somewhat simple. We try to also keep them relatively short. I mean, obviously, the longer the episode, the longer it takes to edit. And like I said, we dedicate a couple days and just work on it nonstop, and then finally, you know, at the end of it, we go, finally, publish. Mm-hmm. And then we sleep for 2 days.
Oh, fair, that's fair.
So, yeah, it's a lot of work. I mean, from start to finish, from script to publish, it can be as much as a month. It could be as little as a week. For instance, when we did the Bortas release party, that episode, literally, it took us a week to put together. We don't, you know, it was all last minute. We had a partial script that we were going to use for something else, so we adapted it and added some more to it, and made some changes, and then got everyone's approval within like 2 days. Finally, then we sat down on the third day, recorded it, and then we had our editor work nonstop for 2 days to get it done, and then we finally posted it, you know, a couple days later. Just in time for the big Star Trek Online. I believe it was the anniversary event.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was great. That was a lot of fun. It was ridiculously, you know, short notice and all. I don't think our editor has ever forgiven us since then.
Speaking of anniversaries, Have you seen any of the Star Trek, like the first season Blu-ray remastered stuff?
No, not yet, but I'm definitely interested in checking out the Blu-rays. I've seen, you know, some of the commercials, some of the still photos, and it looks phenomenal.
Because I was always, I wasn't that interested in it, because, like, I don't have a Blu-ray player, and as a rule, I'm not that interested in special effects. But I was very curious about this supposed, like, 22 extra minutes of footage that they have for A Measure of a Man. And I'm very curious to know what that is. Like,
yeah, that does sound very interesting. I mean, Measure of a Man is that episode with Data where he's basically has to defend his right to sentience.
Yeah, which I guess we're not going to find out because that's a season 2 episode, and season 2 isn't going to be released for a while.
But, yeah, I think I'm hearing sometime, probably next year.
Yeah, because that's just a lot of footage. That's like almost half the episode.
Yeah, that's like almost a movie. I mean, that's a television movie, essentially.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, like, what it... Because part of me, when I first heard that, I was like, oh, man, that's going to be really cool. But then I was wondering, if they cut all of this, maybe there was a reason for that. And I'm just wondering if it's, like, now I'm all worried. Is it going to bog down the episode? Is it going to be, like, 20 minutes of them discussing Data's technical schematics? I don't know.
I think mostly they probably wrote it as like a two-part cliffhanger, but by that time they weren't quite ready to do a two-part cliffhanger type episode. In fact, the
that
first one was with Best of Both Worlds.
Yeah,
and we know how that turned out. I think this was much the same way. Oh, Kapla, brother! Oh, wonderful Klingon costumes just walking by. Oh, very, very well done. I think that episode, because there's so much extra footage, it just implies that this would have been either a two-part movie or a two-part episode or a two-hour movie.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing, speaking of Klingons and costumes, do you ever see any Klingons in the Star Trek VI style where they had that, like, that kind of neat, like, red leather motif going on?
Red leather? No. I wish. We also saw something similar in Deep Space Nine for Worf's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wish. That would be totally awesome to see. You know, a pair of Klingon warriors in the red uniform and armor.
Because as much as I like the silver armor, I was starting to wonder: is that how all Klingons dress? Like, is there only one tailor on all of Phobos?
Well, it certainly seems that way, but I think it's more, you know, combat armor. I mean, if you look at say an arm of the military, all the uniforms pretty much look very similar.
That's
so
true.
I think it's more along those lines. Whereas if you're like the Marines or you know the elite, you got a special uniform, and I think that's what the red would indicate. It'd be some kind of, you know, elite task force or something along those lines.
Well, it was the Klingons we were seeing in Star Trek VI were primarily like hanging around the Chancellor, so that would make sense.
Yeah, they could be the Chancellor's guard.
I wonder if that like weird like tusk walking stick that Gorkon had is like a ceremonial like staff of office, or if that was just his personal thing.
I'm not sure. I mean, seeing some kind of paint stick would be, you know, would kind of make sense for a Klingon, some kind of like not a weapon necessarily, but something that, you know, if needed you could bash a head in or something.
Yeah, well, sometimes you gotta.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Have you seen any of the performances that the various actors are doing? Like, I know Armin Shimerman and Jeffrey Combs and Casey Biggs are doing one, and I think Garrett Wong and Dominic Keating and Connor Trinneer, is that his name? Yeah, they're doing. Have you seen either of those?
No, I have not, but I've heard some good things from all of them about all of them.
I'd be interested to see that, because I mean, have you seen Of Gods and Men?
That's one of
the fan production with
production. It's almost like a movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a 3-part online movie directed by Tim Russ. It has Nichelle Nichols and Garrett Wong and a few. And it has I can't remember the guy who played Martok, but it has him.
Is that the one with the Doomsday Machine in it?
No, it's the one with is it Charlie X? No, it's
okay.
Yeah, it is Charlie X. It's the superpowered kid. The plot of the movie is that the superpowered kid from the TOS, like one of the early TOS episodes, goes back in time and makes it so Kirk is never born, and so the guy from Where No Man Has Gone Before, what's his name? The dude who got superpowers from smacking into the galactic barrier. Gary Mitchell.
Yes.
He's like, because Kirk wasn't around, Gary Mitchell is like the supreme overlord of the universe. And it's, you know,
alternate universe, yes.
It's got its ups and downs. It's got a really interesting premise. But in the first like third of it, it really feels like the actors are reading their lines for the first time. They don't entirely know how they're supposed to say them. So they've got weird inflections, but that gets better as it goes on. But the reason I brought it up was because I've always wanted to see, because like in that one, we got to see a little bit of what Garrett Wong could do when he isn't playing Harry Kim. I kind of want to see a little bit more of that. I was talking with David about that a little earlier, so just across.
Mike, I can't hear what's being said by Oren, but hopefully you guys can hear me. Are you guys able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. Can you not hear me?
Okay, cool. So in about, just want to give everybody an update. In about 10 minutes after the conclusion of All Things Trek, we're going to have Rod Roddenberry come by the Trek Radio booth and talk about Trek Nation, talk about some of his other projects. And then we're going to have another special guest after that. So we're going to have a lot of, that's the way things are around here. You know, it's kind of quiet, and then all of a sudden, boom, you got a bunch of people wanting to come talk to Trek Radio. So we're going to get to that soon at the top of the hour.
Sweet.
What have we guys been talking about? I heard some really good.
Right now we're talking about Of Gods of Men.
Oh, that's awesome.
The writing about it and whatnot. You were saying, Oren, that it seemed like the first third of it was kind of, well, I think, you know, the characters were starting, the actors were starting to, you know, just figure out what the characters were trying to do. I believe if these fan productions took years to produce. So, you know, getting the feel for the characters, that certainly takes some time. I mean, looking at Gates, I mean, if you were to, for instance, listen to one of our early episodes and then flash forward to one of our newest episodes, you're almost going to wonder, is this the same show? So I think it was just the people, the actors, you know, trying to get a feel for what the script was calling for, what the director was wanting, and whatnot. I think everyone was learning what was
true. What it was for me, the reason why it kind of took me out of like on the first third of it was like when we do our rehearsals for whatever it is we're doing, you know, the first read through the script, it's not so much that they haven't found their character voices yet, it's that they don't quite know exactly how the sentence is meant to be read. So like they'll add like a question mark at the end of sentences that don't have them, or they will read questions like statements. And that's what the first third of Gods and Men sounds like to me. It's like, I feel like this is a problem they could have fixed with another, like, you know, another read-through of the script.
Either that or have maybe the director be actually involved. For instance, when Gates records, we try to get everyone together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes having people all over the country, let alone the world, that isn't always feasible. So a lot of actors will have their own studios at home and will record the lines themselves,
right,
and not get any feedback from the director until after they recorded. Well, you know, the director may or the editor may listen to the lines, say, okay, this sounds okay enough. Let's see how it sounds. Let's, you know, start editing everything together. And then, you know, things, you know, it just all depends on how involved the director and or the editors are in the process.
Yeah, that was like when I was still doing Tales from the DMZ, I had all four of my main cast members lived within like easy travel distance of my apartment where we do the recording. Mm-hmm. I would sometimes have like guest stars record their lines separately and then send them in, but I thought it was really important to be able to have the main characters be able to play off each other. and be able to react to how the other person was reading their lines. So that's not a luxury you always have when you're doing audio, when you're doing an audio drama.
Very true. And, you know, usually, like I can only, explain how our process with Gates works. But with us, usually we have the script writer there in the room. So either that's myself or Hawook or Garth. And, that way we know what the original intent is. And if it doesn't match what we want, we will ask them to do the line again. Whereas if you don't have that feedback, you're just going to continue on with your lines and hope, that's good enough. And, hope that, you don't have to do, retakes later on. And sometimes, depending on time, retakes can sometimes be impossible to get.
I've had one or two episodes where I've gotten through the end and, they finished editing and realized that I forgot a line. Like, there was just a line that for some reason we never recorded. And it's like, where is that line? I don't, what? And then I would, then you have to track down the actor and be like, I need you to say this line for me.
Yes, we've done that a few times. And there's been a couple times where we just had to say, this line isn't as important as, everything that we already have recorded. So, sometimes things get overlooked or get missed. And either it ends up remaining lost or it will, come back. But tracking down the line can take some time sometimes.
Yeah, I've had one of the nice things about doing the editing is there have been one or two instances where I have just, I have just cut a line because I was just like, this line is kind of unnecessary. It isn't really needed.
Yes.
Like at the end of, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the entry that we put in for the G&T audio drama product, audio drama contest, but there was at the end of it, the main character, the captain, was going to say one more thing to the guy who's beaming into the engineering with her. And at the end, I was like, it was supposed to be the idea of it at the end was supposed to be reinforcing the seriousness of the situation. But when I listened to it, it just kind of sounded like she was making fun of him. I don't think this line needs to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, what's on the page and how everything finally sounds, when it's time to edit things and get things going. I mean, it's all the process. I mean, you're going through everything and then you have to, you actually hear what it sounds like and how the characters are playing off each other. And yeah, sometimes the best thing to do is lose some lines that may not have been translated from the page exactly as the writer had originally expected. That's not unusual.
Do you guys how much music do you add to the Gates or to the Gates of Stovercore?
Well, for instance, the bar scene, we try to we're trying to portray a very lively environment. So we've got the Gates of Stovercore house band, El Troubadour. We've got usually a crowded bar with people serving food and eating and drinking and sometimes a fist fight or two breaks out, we try to create this environment, and that's usually where we have most of our music. Lately we've been experimenting with moving away from the bar, and in those situations we don't really use a lot of music, but we will try to create environments that are somewhat what we would imagine. For instance, on one of the recent raid episodes, we had a lot of combat firing and people running around, and so we tried to use that to kind of kickstart the imagination and allow people to see or imagine, what's going on. Music can certainly help, portray some of that emotion, some of, what is actually happening. But it's not wanting to use too much copyright material and whatnot. So there are a lot of hoops. So using music isn't always, we're not always able to get away with that.
Well, I will toss this out for you. This is just a practical resource. If you go to Kevin MacLeod's website, Incompetech, I think it's just incompetech.com, but if you Google Kevin MacLeod and Incompetech, it'll come up. He just has a whole ton of completely royalty-free public domain music that on the very rare instance I've ever decided to put music in one of my shows, that's where I've gotten it from.
Ah, interesting. I'll have to such, keep that in mind.
It's pretty handy.
Very cool, very cool.
So I swear I had more questions about this Star Trek convention that's happening. Although I do love talking about Gates of Stovacor, because I really love doing audio drama, and I wish I had time to do more of it. Do you have anything in particular that you're looking forward to seeing?
Rod Roddenberry coming up in just moments.
David is telling me Rod Roddenberry is coming up in just a few moments. Something that I'm looking forward to at the convention. Let's see. I have a photo op coming up with Michael Dorn. That's going to be pretty cool. I'm actually going to approach him and ask him if he'd be interested in providing a line or two for us sometime in the future as Worf.
All right. Well, I will let you go then, because I don't want to stand in the way of Ron Roddenberry. So I wish you guys luck with that, and enjoy the rest of the convention.
Thank you. We are certainly having a good time. So,
all right. Well, for anyone who was actually listening to this for All Things Trek, this is Oren signing off. I will see you guys next week.